Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. 1 in 5 Americans live in a multi-generational household. That means at least 2 separate adult generations share the space. Think grandparents, parents, kids, maybe aunts and uncles, all living under the same roof. And the number of these households has been going up in recent years. Our associate producer, Xavier Lopez, lived with his extended family as a kid.
We moved here to the United States from Ecuador. It was kind of a big change because we lived in this big home back in Ecuador, in Manta. And when we got here, we lived in the basement of my aunt's house. I was 8. This was back in 2002.
His aunt's house was in Queens. Xavier, his parents, and his sister moved into a basement apartment with other family members. And how big was the space?
It was not that big. It was only 2 rooms. One of the rooms was for me and my immediate family, and the other room was for my aunt and her husband and my cousin. And then my grandmother would sleep in the living room. She had these little like dividers, curtain things that would kind of like separate her from the rest of the room. It was kind of like a small attempt at privacy in a very not so private place.
Okay, so that's 1, 2, 3, 5 adults and then 3 children.
That's correct.
So did you all get on each other's nerves? I mean, it sounds cramped.
Oh, yeah, like constantly. We would always get on each other's nerves. It's just kind of bound to happen. It's such a small place. But, you know, like we also had some really good times. I think like that's just what happens with family.
Xavier has a lot of happy memories of hanging out with his parents and his grandma.
And, you know, my grandmother would take care of us. She would cook dinner for us while everybody else was working. And we would take care of her, you know. It was kind of a symbiotic relationship. Watching Sábado Gigante and, like, the old Mexican movies on Univision and Telemundo.
El búho.
El búho. El búho. El búho.
Big family parties and music. Always music.
My uncle, he's a saloon singer. He kind of just like on the weekends would make the rounds in this little Ecuadorian part of Queens, going to the nightclubs and then singing. And he would practice in our basement, which would be his, in the boiler room in our basement, which would be his quote-unquote studio. So you'd always hear these like, what they're called cortavenas, which is basically like these old Hispanic love songs that Latino men love to listen to while they drink. It really built in the soundtrack to this time in my life that I kind of adore.
Xavier's immediate family got their own place when he was in high school.
We moved into our own 2-bedroom apartment just for the 4 of us, which is still not a lot of space, but it was enough. It was better than what we were living in.
Multi-generational living saves resources, from rent and utilities to smaller items.
How many cable box subscriptions does one need? How many mops and buckets, you know? So there's a lot of spending that's involved in setting up a household.
Living together can mean free childcare. It can strengthen relationships and give kids a sense of security. But it can also have a negative impact, especially when the space is small. Stress is one thing, but during this pandemic, sharing small spaces has had a devastating impact on many families.
We're seeing more and more evidence that housing is really a health issue.
On today's episode, an inside look at multi-generational living. First up, Xavier Lopez picks up the story that caught his attention as the pandemic unfolded. Having lived with a bunch of family members in a small space, Xavier quickly realized that staying at home would not be safer for a lot of people. Instead, it might expose them to bigger risks of infection.
Growing up like this can feel kind of odd. I didn't really think about it much in my adult life until I started working on this piece. And I put out a call on social media. I heard back from Anna Cordero. She's a friend of a friend from back in Queens. And we quickly bonded over being from Ecuador, having lived in a relative's basement, and feeling embarrassed about it.
I had to decide which friends I could trust in order to be like, hey, come over and let me show you the way that we live. And I would find myself apologizing for the living situation.
Anna told me about the first time she felt shame about living this way. She was in the third grade.
And I had a science project to do on plants with my friend Jackie. I remember we were trying to decide whose house we should go over so that we can do this project. And she was talking about how, oh, I can put the plants here in my backyard and my mom can make us snacks. And when we're not doing the project, we can play on my trampoline. And I was like, girl, you have a trampoline? And I was just gonna tell her, like, hey, I have this window in the kitchen where we can keep the plants.
When Anna's family first got to the U.S., they lived with her great aunt, the Olguita. After a few years, they moved out on their own, but their family splintered. Anna's father was very abusive towards her mother.
I remember at the worst, I believe, my dad was choking my mom outside in front of the neighbors, and the police came. And I think that was the last incident that we had before we went to the shelter.
They stayed in the shelter for a while, then bounced around, spending some time back with the Olguita. After that, a rundown two-bedroom with a bedbug infestation. Anna's mom tried to find a place that was within their price range, but it was just impossible in an ever-gentrifying New York. She applied to public housing, but didn't get an answer. 6 years ago, they finally found a one-bedroom apartment. First, it was just Anna, her brothers Luis and Diego, and their mom, who is also named Anna. Soon, the family grew. Diego's girlfriend, Adamari, also moved in. And soon after, they had two kids, Elijah and Journey. Three generations under the same roof, again.
My mother, Anna, myself, and my brother, Louis, get the living room, which is the bigger space. And we divide that living room into different sections so that we each get our space because the living room allows for that.
Anna says these spaces are mostly for sleeping. She and her brother each get their own bed, and their mom sleeps on a reclining couch.
And then you head over down the hall to the actual bedroom, and that's where Diego shares a space with his girlfriend Adamari and the two babies.
Seven people sharing around 700 square feet. While living in those cramped quarters made their situation stressful at times, there were a lot of good aspects too. Anna says it brought them closer together when the family wasn't arguing. And although her childhood was filled with trauma, when her brother Diego fell in love and had kids, it was a turning point for the family.
The abuse that we all faced together kind of tore us apart. And so my brother having children really gave us a reason to come together for a common cause, is that we all love these children.
With new life came hope for a happier future.
I think that's the brightest thing that's come out of all of this. Like, to have the opportunity to see my niece and my nephew frequently and to take care of them really feels like a privilege. I love being able to play a role in their lives, and I really don't see that happening the way it is happening if we weren't able to be in such close quarters with each other.
Then the pandemic hit. The virus quickly tore through New York.
So we're going to put out an executive order today. New York State on pause. Two basic rules. Only essential businesses will be functioning. Second rule, remain indoors to the greatest extent to protect physical and mental health.
In March, people were asked to shelter in place to flatten the curve and reduce the risk of infection. All of us heard the same PSAs from elected officials and celebrities alike.
Hello, this is Robert De Niro.
Hi, everybody, it's Danny DeVito.
We really have to all stay at home. It's the only way that we're going to stop the spread of this virus.
Not just to protect ourselves, but to protect others and all the older people you love.
And I'm asking you from the bottom of my heart, all over the state of New York, stay home.
But for families like Anna's and mine, staying home was not safer. Home was where the danger was.
When my mom got sick, we did not have the same opportunities to isolate the way we would have wanted.
In Anna's family, the illness started with her great aunt, the Elguita, the one that took them in when they first came to the United States, and again when they were homeless. Elguita started having symptoms of the virus in late February.
She had been telling my mom that she had been feeling sick, and she was just anticipating like a yearly flu that she gets, right?
Anna's mom was also taking care of Elguita.
So at this point, my mom doesn't have any actual days off. She's either working or taking care of my aunt.
Elguita went to the hospital twice and was diagnosed with pneumonia. She was sent home with antibiotics, but she didn't get any better. She ended up back at the hospital, and this time she was tested for COVID, but her condition was deteriorating rapidly.
The doctor said that she had 50% lung function at that point, and she got intubated. They had a talk about how that they would let us know how she would progress throughout the night. And then some point throughout the night, they called my mom to tell her that she had passed.
Then the family got more bad news.
And we got a call from the hospital saying that they had the test results. And they told us that it came out positive. And so we were just asking, like, why are you telling us this right now? And then that's when they realized that she had already passed in the hospital that they were calling from.
They confirmed what the family had feared all along, that the Elguita had been sick with COVID that whole time. Anna's mom had been around her aunt a lot. And that same day, she started having symptoms herself. She had a sore throat, headaches, was feeling really fatigued, and could not get up. Anna went to stay with her boyfriend, Eric.
Because at that point, I didn't feel safe in the apartment with so many people. And that was the last time I got to see my mom for a few months.
The thought of being in that small apartment without any space seemed scary. She feared that if she stayed, she was bound to get sick. And that's exactly what happened with the rest of her family. At first, it was just the mom who got really, really sick.
We got very scared at certain points, and we didn't feel safe enough to go to a hospital because it was just from our belief in what we were seeing on the news and what we had already experienced, that my mom would just be intubated and that she wouldn't come home again.
Anna's mom would have uncontrollable shivers no matter how hot they tried to make the room. There were times when the nausea was so bad that she just wouldn't eat for days. When one symptom eased, another one would pop up.
It was just a plethora of different symptoms that could hit you, and each one lasts several days until that symptom ends, and then another symptom begins, and you get better, and then you get worse. That's what we witnessed for my mom. My brother just needed to rest for a few days, and then the babies got sick.
The virus jumped from Anna's mom to her brother Luis, then to the babies. And once it got to the babies, everybody else who lived in that apartment got sick. Thankfully, no one as bad as Anna's mom. My family got sick too, for the same reasons. My parents and my sister are still living in that same two-bedroom apartment in Queens. But now, my maternal grandmother lives there as well. And this apartment is very small. When you walk in, you're immediately in the kitchen. There's a bathroom through a door on the right, and the other half of this area is occupied by my parents' bed on one side, and a TV and a couch on the other. Then, two doors lead to the bedrooms, my sister's and my grandmother's, the only rooms in the whole apartment with windows. In a place like that, keeping your distance or quarantining is impossible. Everybody is breathing in the same air, in the same small space, walking past each other constantly, data from New York shows that the spread of the virus in crowded living situations was very common.
We found that COVID positive test rates were higher in neighborhoods with more household crowding.
That's Ingrid Gould-Ellen. She's a professor at NYU's Wagner School of Public Service and the director of the Furman Center for Real Estate and Urban Policy. The Furman Center put together a neighborhood analysis that broke down some of the disparities in COVID-19 incidents across neighborhoods. New York City is densely populated everywhere, but there are different kinds of density.
Some of the higher density, highest density neighborhoods in New York, where people live in tall apartment buildings, had some of the lowest rates of positive test cases.
These are affluent areas like Manhattan, where high-rise buildings can house thousands of people in one building. In these places, people have their own separate spaces, their own kitchens and bathrooms, despite living on top of each other, so to speak. Ingrid says that the neighborhoods that were the hardest hit were neighborhoods where the share of the population is overwhelmingly Black and Latino. Another finding from her report was that low educational attainment also correlated with areas that saw high upticks of COVID infection.
In neighborhoods that had lower shares of adults with college degrees, we saw higher positive test rates. And we believe that's because workers without college degrees are more likely to be essential workers, to be workers who can't do their jobs remotely and safely shelter in place.
Essential workers, people working service jobs, janitorial and medical staff, are not able to work from home, which means more contact with people, increasing their chances of infection.
When we say something like, everybody should stay home.
That's Holly Taylor. She's a bioethicist at the National Institutes of Health.
For the vast majority of people, that means, okay, I'm going to stay home. I'm going to figure out how I can telework. If not, how on earth am I going to get my job done? Am I going to lose my job? What does that really mean? Or, okay, I'm going to stay at home, but I live with a lot of different people, and they all have jobs that take them out of the home. And how am I going to actually stay at home and protect myself from risk, right? It's not as easy as, well, just stay at home.
Holly says that the stay-at-home orders and the PSAs didn't fully take into account people living in these multi-generational homes and the dangers that they may be exposed to.
I don't know what Governor Cuomo was thinking, but this is often a challenge that we encounter in public health ethics generally.
She says that coming up with just the right messaging can be very hard for public health experts. And when you're in the thick of it, in an actual emergency, it can be even harder.
One of the things that's often on that list is to make sure that your messages are accurate and actionable and et cetera. But then when you're actually in it and you know that, quote unquote, the most efficient way to reduce spread is for people to not be on the street, right? Not be outside, not be congregating. A message like stay at home is on one hand very simple and on the other hand just too simple.
My family tried to stay at home, but both of my parents have jobs that don't allow them to work from home. My dad is a handyman and my mom is a home health aide. My mom was actually furloughed for a period of time and had to apply for unemployment during the time she was sick. My dad worked through a sickness, even though he shouldn't have, but he just couldn't afford to take off from work. Everyone in my family, thankfully, recovered. Anna's family is doing a lot better now as well. They were all able to get better, although her mom is still not the same.
The situation with my mom is just her dealing with fatigue, but her fatigue is nowhere near as bad as it used to be. So, everyone's doing a lot better now.
Since then, Anna and Eric decided to move out on their own and are currently living in a three-bedroom apartment with two of Eric's cousins, one of whom they took in after she was faced with a situation that left her homeless, an experience that Anna could relate to. Although the past few months have been a roller coaster of emotions, Anna feels like she's finally made peace with everything that's happened.
I definitely do find myself thinking more about it, but I feel calm. I feel a sense of closure now. Like, in the fact that I can help Eric's cousin overcome this obstacle that's in her life, where she could very well be in what could be the lowest point in her life. This could be the lowest point in her life so far. And me being here, being able to help her, it brings me a lot of joy to be able to play that role in her life at the moment, because I really would have needed it. I really would have loved for someone to be able to do this for me.
For The Pulse, I'm Xavier Lopez.
A few weeks after Xavier and Anna's family got sick and recovered from the virus, New York City started a program to offer people a way to quarantine away from family members or roommates, a quarantine hotel room.
There's Wi-Fi, a comfortable bed, a private bathroom.
That's Amanda Catherine Johnson. She directs New York City's Take Care program. And the hotel rooms are part of an effort to connect people who have tested positive for COVID-19 or those who suspect they have the virus to resources.
There are clinical supports on site. So we do have nurses and different levels of nursing assistants who can do things like monitor your temperature, monitor your oxygen saturation using a tool called a pulse oximeter, just making sure that you are safe to stay in the community and to expedite your escalation to a higher level of care if you need it. So if you need to go to the emergency department, getting you there as quickly as possible.
So that's one solution in a time of crisis, but housing and health are connected in many more ways than that, especially when several generations are living together in a very small space. I talked about that with Claudia Solari. She is a senior research associate at the Urban Institute, and she researches overcrowding.
Living in crowded housing has negative effects on educational performance, and I looked specifically at reading performance and math performance, and they were less likely to graduate on time. And we all know that education is really fundamental in being able to offer mobility from poverty. So it really does kind of follow these children later in the life course. There's more strain on the parent-child relationship, that adults in an overcrowded home exhibit less engaged parenting, that, you know, the home as being a place where children are growing, are defining themselves, are, you know, doing their homework and sleeping, that, you know, living in overcrowded and stressful conditions can really negatively affect children's overall well-being outcomes.
And we could only imagine how much this matters right now when kids are not physically in school. They're supposed to be online and they can't get away at all during the day. So it must be that much harder right now.
That's right. And not to mention that my research also found that living in crowded housing has negative effects on their behavioral health and physical health. People are trying to work at home. People are trying to study at home. People are trying to live at home all day. Children can't go to school and kind of have the space and resources outside of the home. They can't go to the public library and use the resources there to do their homework. I think a lot of folks in child welfare are really concerned about increases in child maltreatment, especially those that are going unreported because there's not as much exposure to mandatory reporters. Like, teachers are mandatory reporters, and when you're not in the classroom and having that one-on-one time with the students to ask them about what's going on, why didn't you turn in your homework, you have kind of less oversight.
What are some potential solutions? What could help this situation?
Well, I think there are short-term and long-term solutions that need to be considered.
Okay.
So you know, on the long term, I think we knew we needed to expand affordable housing before the pandemic. And it's just even clearer now that we do not have enough affordable units available for extremely low-income households and low-income households.
Claudia says that the federal housing voucher program has shown to be effective.
People who receive the voucher can use it in the private housing market, present it to landlords, and they would pay 30% of whatever their income is, and the remainder would get covered by the subsidy.
So this opens up more options outside of public housing, and the apartment or house has to meet specific quality standards, and it has to be big enough for the family.
So if we expand this program to reach more people in need, that would really help alleviate housing crowding and, you know, prevent lots of possible housing instability in the future.
What do we know in terms of the costs, Claudia? If we were able to stabilize our housing market with a voucher program, how much would that cost and how much would it save potentially?
We do have a figure to estimate how much it would cost if we were to bring all renter households to a point where 30% of their income goes to rent, and it would cost $15.5 billion per month, which sounds like a lot, but the cost of doing nothing is likely to be much higher than actually taking preventative steps. I think rates of housing crowding and homelessness are bound to increase if we don't do anything. And it would lead to more health risks and higher rates of COVID. I mean, the kind of snowball effect that would happen if we don't protect the housing market, you know, like we had protected other industries in times of economic crisis, that we're really in for a painful shock for households across the country.
That's Claudia Solari. She is a senior research associate at the Urban Institute.
The Commonwealth Fund supports the Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable, quality health care for everyone.
Having a few generations under the same roof was the way most American families lived about 100 years ago.
At the start of the 1900s, almost 6 in 10 of the nation's seniors lived in a multi-generational household.
That's Richard Fry. He is a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. So at the start of the last century, most people over 65 lived with their families. But then that number started to drop and drop.
For one, over the course of the decades, we had Social Security. Elderly Americans had rising incomes. And so one of the things they presumably wanted with their rising incomes was privacy. In other words, with rising incomes, they had the wherewithal to buy more privacy, so to speak, or basically live independently.
People were also living longer and staying healthier.
They didn't need the care of other family members as much as they did earlier in the century.
And then we see a rise in multi-generational housing again. When does this happen and why does it happen?
So the bottom was 1980, where about 12% of Americans were living in a multi-generational household. And then it began sort of a long, slow rise. It accelerated during the course of the Great Recession, and we have tracked it up through 2016. It had risen to about 20%, one in five. And so it's not quite back up to sort of where it was at 1900, but it's headed that way.
Richard says one of the many driving factors is the changing population, immigration trends.
The foreign-born share of the population was about 5% in the 1960s. It's now up to about 14%. And immigrants are much more likely to choose to live in multi-generational living arrangements. In terms of sort of racial ethnic breakdowns, the groups that are most likely to live in multi-generational households are Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans. Well, those are the very groups that, population-wise, they've been the growing groups.
There's also been a big increase in young adults that live in multi-generational households.
It's rather sort of startling how much it's increased among them. In 1980, if we look at 25 to 29-year-olds, only 13% of them were living in a multi-generational household. Now, as of 2016, a third of 25 to 29-year-olds are living in a multi-generational household.
So why do you think are we seeing a rise in I guess, young adults living with their parents?
This got a lot of attention the past 10 years with the Great Recession. But this has been increasing for a long time, ever since basically about 1960. It's been rising for the last 60 years. Now, there's a few reasons that we can point to. For less educated men in particular, their wages, once you adjust for inflation, their wages have been falling over the decades since the 1970s. And so just in terms of sort of their, you know, economic ability to live independently, it's declining over time because they're experiencing falling wages. Another factor is, again, sort of this long haul. Over the last three or four decades, generally college going is up. And when we talk about college going, what people typically have in their heads is, oh, the student is off in some college dormitory. But no, that's not actually not how a lot of college students go to college. A lot of them choose to live at home and either go to the community college or sort of the local public four-year college. And so as college going has increased over the decades, remember, some of them are pursuing their studies by living at home. And so growing college enrollment has also contributed to more young adults living with their parents.
Richard says the struggle to pay off student loans and rising rents also play a role. As for how the pandemic will impact multi-generational households, Richard says it's still too early to tell, but he expects the general trend to continue to rise. Richard Fry is an economist at the Pew Center for Research in Washington, D.C. We're talking about multi-generational living and how it impacts people's health. Sometimes multi-generational living is a way to do something that used to be way more common back in the day. Take care of a loved one who is sick or dying at home. Reporter Jad Slayman has the story of two families.
The doctor had bad news for the Amaya family, and he didn't sugarcoat anything because he couldn't. He was talking to three nurses: Amanda Amaya, her father, and the patient, Amanda's mom, Gigi.
She had a tumor the size of a baseball in the back of her skull. And I knew, all three of us knew with our nursing knowledge, that that was terminal. We didn't need the doctor to tell us that.
Nursing is kind of the family business.
My dad first was a corpsman in the military, in the Air Force. He became a nurse shortly after I was born. And then my mom became a nurse when I was about 8 years old. So it was kind of inevitable.
Gigi was diagnosed in early 2018. And when she was still healthy enough, the family went on a bucket list cruise along the Mexican Gulf Coast. They knew death was coming and accepted it. Or at least most of them did.
My brother is not medical. He refers to himself as the black sheep of the family. So he didn't always understand, but he really didn't want to understand this process. He refused to believe it. So he would say that, you know, he called it the "this is an over" cruise.
Sometimes it felt like that to Amanda too. Gigi by then was weak, bald from chemo, but they forgot about the cancer here and there for a while.
It would just fade away and we would kind of joke about things, and we would joke about how she would haunt us after she passed and the things she would do to kind of mess with us.
After the bucket list cruise, there was the bucket list NFL game.
She was a rabid Pittsburgh Steelers fan and she wanted to see the Steelers play. And in true fashion, they lost to the Ravens.
By June of that year, the family knew they were in the home stretch. It was time to get down to the business of dying. Gigi said she wanted to die at home. And with everybody's medical background, they all understood why.
With my mom and with my work experience, when you've experienced the traumatic part of it, where you've seen and extubated people in the ICU.
Extubation means when the breathing tube is removed, as in when someone is taken off of life support.
I think you do start thinking, okay, how do I want this to look when it's my turn?
They all knew they didn't want that. It was this image, one that they'd all seen, of the breathing tube removed, of everything unhooked and unplugged at the end, the tangle of wires and machinery. To the family, that wasn't a good death. Most of us prefer dying at home. But at the same time, research shows most of us don't get to. Amanda's entire family rallied to make Gigi's wish possible. Amanda's family, her brother's family, all their kids all moved in together, three generations now in Gigi's house.
It was pretty much all hands on deck. We just crammed all of our stuff into their house with our two cats and their two dogs.
They ran the place like a tiny hospital ward. Amanda took day shift while also working for a telehealth company. Her dad took nights.
Yeah, we had a clipboard going. So I would write out her medication, when she could have her morphine, when she could have her Ativan.
They would report off to each other just like they might at a nurse's station.
You know, we would like initial like we would do in the hospital, like who gave what at what time.
Amanda tells me this highly regimented system made things easier in practical ways, but also in emotional ways. It let her compartmentalize.
It helped me get through it because it was tasks that I knew I had to do versus me thinking about it being my mom.
Things didn't always go smoothly, which the nurses in the family were used to. But the whole family is here, including Amanda's daughters. The oldest was 11 at the time.
And I said, Gigi is sick, and we're family, and we take care of family.
Amanda couldn't completely shield her kids from the dying process.
But it was a little bit, I wouldn't say traumatic, but it was a little bit scary for them when they would see her fall. Because, you know, there's usually blood, there's usually my mom, you know, on top of me, and we're trying to get up.
Amanda and her father had watched countless people die. They could confidently predict Gigi's death down to the day.
We would be out in the living room, and just nobody wanted to leave because everybody wanted to be there.
One of the neighbors invited one of Amanda's daughters, who was especially close to Gigi, to a sleepover.
We didn't want her to feel like she had to stay and be an adult with, you know, the adult situations going on.
Amanda told her daughter, say goodbye to grandma, to know that when she got back, Gigi might not be around, and that was okay. Go ahead and be a kid. In the end, Amanda says, they nearly predicted Gigi's death down to the very hour. It was 5 p.m. She'd spent the day listening to her favorite band. It was football Sunday, or in the Amaya house, more precisely, it was Steeler Sunday. During Gigi's last moments, there was no breathing tube huffing away, no beeping monitors. There was only Gigi's breath and her family there listening.
I mean, the gaps in between breathing get longer and longer until the breathing finally stops.
As nurses, they could tell just by looking the moment that she was gone.
After she had passed and the hospice nurse comes out, and they had, you know, taken her body and everything. We did shots in her memory and we all got drunk.
It was tequila.
And we just told Gigi stories.
Who wouldn't want to make sure that a loved one got to go out that way? The thing is, Gigi was really, really lucky. Not everyone comes from a nursing clan.
Hospice itself does not have a caregiver provision in it. It's intermittent care. So it does not provide for someone to come and sit with your loved one.
Usually that means a nurse coming to the house a few times a week.
So if you work and your loved one was like my mom, who needed supervision 24/7, if I didn't move in with my parents, my dad would have had to pay for somebody out of pocket to sit with my mom. And that gets extremely expensive.
Amanda's worked hospice before, and she says this kind of thing surprises people all the time. The sheer amount of work it takes to allow someone to die at home, the incredible cost of making it possible without family there and able to help. The Amayas are maybe the best case scenario when it comes to dying at home. I mean, they're all professional nurses who know death, who know dying, and who know how to do it right. That's important because the way most insurance works, there just isn't that much focus on paying for care that happens outside of hospitals. It's why families, ordinary non-medical families, end up doing most of the end-of-life care on their own. I talked to another family caregiver going through this right now who represents the kind of scenario that's probably much more common.
My name is Verena Bertium, and I am from Massachusetts.
Verena is taking care of her husband, who's dying of ALS, a neurodegenerative disease. He's in his 50s.
Right now, he cannot do much on his own. He needs assistance for everything.
She lives with her father, who suffered a stroke recently and can't really help out. And she's also got 4 young kids in the house to look after.
I wish COVID was not here. I wish there was not a pandemic, and because that actually complicated everything.
Verena's husband was a special forces soldier before retiring a couple years back. The VA used to send nurses to help out a few days a week, but with COVID, Verena is too scared to let him in the house. So now it's just her. She takes care of her husband, she looks after her kids, and she works full time.
I teach Spanish in middle school.
She's even working on her master's degree. My first question when I heard all this was, how? Like, what about sleep?
I usually get about 4.5 hours, 5 hours the most every night. And I know it will probably cause something along the road.
Verena and her husband have 4 kids, and they do help out with the care. They bring Dad special nutrition shakes, sometimes ice cream. The VA gave Verena a kind of hoist kit to lift her hulking special forces husband off the bed.
My husband is 6'4", and I am 5'3".
Instead, she just puts a kid on either side of him, and the 3 lift together. Verena says he's the kind of dad that wouldn't survive long without family nearby.
He used to take our daughters for daddy-daughter dates. They would take turns and they would go just with him and go and have some, you know, lunch.
The kids, though, have paid a price.
My children have gone through anxiety, through panic attacks. They have gone through depression.
Amid all that, there are good days, too.
One day I was outside and a florist, you know, a delivery truck comes and it comes with this beautiful bouquet of flowers.
Verena thought there's no chance these are for her because who would send them? But the card said they were.
I look at the card. It's a card. And the card says, thank you for all that you do and all that you are. And it says, Alan, that's my husband's name. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, like, I said, I know my husband didn't do it because, you know, he can't. He can't go to the store and buy them.
She showed the flowers to her husband, like, check this out. Who could have sent these?
So he points at himself. He starts pointing at him. I'm like, so what? You did it?
It turns out, back when the hospice nurse was still visiting, her husband used this text communicator to convince her to have flowers delivered later, in secret.
Oh, it's such a wonderful thing. And that told me it was still him, you know? It's still him. He had not changed. It's his body, but not him. He's still Alan.
Verena calls this new life of hers, where she plays the role of wife, of mom, of nurse, of student and teacher all at once, where she only sleeps for 4 hours a night, the new normal. She knows she can't do it forever, but of course, she also knows that she won't have to.
This is God's plan for us, for our family. You know, it's not a punishment. You know, it's something that we have to go through in this life, and we will do it together.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
Coming up, multi-generational living as a way to make it through a lockdown.
My grandma, she's showing us the garden in each season.
Thought we'd have a look at the things that have changed in the autumn.
My pomegranate.
That's next on The Pulse.
We'll have a look.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about multi-generational living and how it impacts people's health. Earlier on, we heard about how this setup played a role during the pandemic and the spread of coronavirus. But in that same story, there was also a lot of talk about the deep bonds that develop when families share the same space. And that aspect of multi-generational living has been really helpful for a lot of families, especially during these lockdowns. Rachel Bongiorno takes us to visit her family in Melbourne, where three generations live in the same house.
Hi, my name's Emily. I'm 8 years old and I'm turning 9 in 2 days.
Hi, my name's Sienna and I'm 7. I live with my grandma, my dad, my mum, Auntie Rachel.
For the past 6 years, I've been living in New York City, but earlier this year I decided it was time to come home, mostly to spend time with my mum, who just turned 82. My dad passed away when I was young, and she lives with my older sister, her husband, and their two kids. I'd planned on living with my family for a couple of months and then get my own place. But then the pandemic hit. Moving out wasn't really a possibility, and I wanted to be close to help out my mum.
We're ready.
My name's Rose. I have 9 children, and I have 14 grandchildren. During lockdown, it's been very difficult because I've only been able to see the two children who actually live here.
In early July, Melbourne became the epicentre of Australia's second wave, and we had one of the longest lockdowns in the world. You could only leave your home to go to the grocery store, a medical appointment, or an hour's exercise. And there was also an 8 p.m. curfew. For the kids, this meant trying to find interesting activities around our home. My mum, who's also a teacher, is great at making the best out of what we have.
So we'll walk round to the side of the house.
My grandma, she's showing us the garden in each season.
Thought we'd have a look at the things that have changed in the autumn.
My pomegranates.
We'll have a look. It was challenging trying to think of different creative things for them to do because they would get bored very quickly.
Grandma, remember that flower? Remember how you lost it?
Yeah.
That's because it changed into a bud.
Is that ready to pick?
No.
At the
back it's yellow. So.
The isolation we've felt in the pandemic has been tough for all of us, but especially for elders who are most vulnerable to the virus. Having us all under one roof has been comforting, especially for my mum.
Well, definitely, I think it would have been extremely lonely if I'd been in lockdown on my own. And we introduced some regular things like games night.
Oh, am I an object?
No.
Am I a person?
No. I think living with children definitely has a positive impact on people of my generation because, one, it keeps you young, keeps you on the ball because you have to keep up with even different ways of speaking. They'll say, oh, you know, don't you know that word, Grandma? And it's a word that has possibly changed its meaning over the years. Also, the music that they listen to, popular on the radio. And sometimes they will say, well, don't listen to the words of this song, Grandma, because you might be shocked. But the music is good. I love it when you
call me, señorita. My family's Italian, and we've always lived with our grandparents. But around Australia, there's an upward trend in multi-generational households. Elizabeth Shaw is a psychologist and CEO of Relationships Australia New South Wales. She says that multi-generational living is especially beneficial for the oldest and youngest generations.
For younger children, if they've got a positive relationship with their grandparents, that will stand them in good stead the rest of their lives, because grandparents often do have the time and space to be attentive and affirming and validating.
Look what's happened.
The kids can have fun with their grandparents often and learn nice things.
They come for their dinner.
Dad.
They come in the morning and they come at night.
And we also have magpies. It is fun to live with my grandma because sometimes when I'm scared in bed, I go to my grandma's bed. And yeah, I think they read stories and play games. My grandma teaches us, like, stories about stuff that were when we weren't born. Grandma teaches us how to wipe the table, but not pack up, because we know how to pack up.
When it comes to different age groups, grandparents particularly liked having grandchildren around.
That's Dr. Edgar Liu, a senior research fellow at the University of New South Wales Cities Futures Research Centre. He studies equitable housing policy and has researched multi-generational living.
And that goes the same with parents as well, the middle generation as well, that they actually like having that family connection across the different generations, that they can actually pass on knowledge from one generation to the next.
Edgar says that while housing affordability is one of the key drivers behind the growth in multi-generational living, those he interviews say that companionship is one of the biggest benefits, but that constant companionship can also come with its challenges.
And I remember this one quote from an interviewee, and she said, yeah, it's great that there's always someone there, but at the same time, there's always someone there. You just can't escape.
But like any relationship, Elizabeth Shaw says that open and honest communication is key.
Even calling family meetings, it sounds, you know, really like something you do on television, but, you know, sometimes it could be you could go around the room and say, let's all talk about one thing we appreciate about how we've managed this. And what's one thing that's really annoying that we could change? And then it's a norm, it's a group norm that everyone's had permission to say something.
After several months of lockdown, Melbourne has finally got the virus under control, having recorded zero new cases for the past month. It's a relief. The kids are back at school, we're allowed to go out and meet friends, but there's still plenty of time at home to teach Grandma new tricks.
We are going to be doing rock, paper, scissors with Grandma, and we're going to have to teach her. So, a paper covers rock, a rock smashes scissors, and scissors cuts paper. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
So Emily had paper and I had scissors.
For The Pulse, I'm Rachel Bongiorno.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jed Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.